ever gone before.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gar Alperovitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Alperovitz.
Glad to be with you. Thanks, Ian.
And it's pretty clear that in the next week or so, as we approach this so-called fiscal cliff in January, that the same kind of drumbeat from the deficit hawks, who after all have framed this thing in terms of a fiscal cliff in these apocalyptic terms, in fact, the reason we have this so-called fiscal cliff is because of the Tea Party extremists who back last year brought the country to the brink of losing its full faith and credit and having its debt downgraded. And this sequester deal was a result of that kind of reckless behavior. So I'm surprised that the president and everybody is taking this so seriously. It feels like a trap to me. They talk about a grand bargain, but I'm afraid there could be a grand betrayal going on here.
Well, it's obvious that the whole thing, the whole debate is skewed nationally way to the right. We sort of take for granted that we must, this is the richest economy in the history of the world. And the idea that we would be tied up over this deficit issue is a reflection of how conservative, as you say, all skewed to the right, the whole debate has become, not only because of the Tea Party, but because of the weakness of the progressive side that hasn't pushed Obama into taking a much stronger position. The Paul Krugman every day argues the Keynesian case for expanding the deficit in order to grow the economy. And there certainly is a traditional liberal case that could be made for that, let alone a radical case. But the debate has been taken over by the right and by the Tea Party, and Obama is working within that constraint, and so far has shown no indication that he's willing to really go to the country and try to turn it around.
Well, it's also, you know, MSNBC is supposedly the liberal media, and Chris Matthews of MSNBC has been basically telling Paul Krugman to shut up, saying you're a columnist. We're talking, you know, about great matters of state. Well, first of all, you know, Krugman's more than a columnist. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist whose Nobel Prize is in macroeconomics. So surely he's qualified to speak on this matter.
Well, it's ridiculous to say he should be quiet on this matter. And not only that, the argument is very well supported throughout any part of the advanced economics field that strong buildup of deficits is important at this time to get the economy into high gear. I once had an elderly aunt who told me kind of the best thing I ever learned about economics, and I'm an economist. She said, you know, I lived in the Depression, and there wasn't much money around in the Depression, and we had a lot of unemployment. And then they decided to have a war, and all of a sudden there was a lot of money around, which meant, obviously, if you want to, if you have the political will, the economy could be put into high gear, and what's stopping it is not economics. Let me put it this way. We don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest economy in the world, and we've taken a right-wing or very conservative approach to that and allowed ourselves to be boxed in.
So this is odd, though, isn't it, Gar Alperovitz, that we have a blue country with a purple polity, or if not, a red polity?
Now, I wish our country were bluer. I think the underlying structural problem, the reason we don't have a stronger liberal politics at the moment, I think, is a decline of labor. Throughout the advanced industrial world, if you don't have strong labor unions, you have a weak progressive politics. And I don't know if we're going to rebuild labor. We're going to have to build new institutions of some kind to support a progressive politics. We're seeing a lot of worker-owned companies and co-ops and maybe the kinds of ingredients that might go into a new institutional base to build a power base. But at the moment, we're in a, I think a lot of our weakness comes from the fact that labor is so weak, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with Guy Opowitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official, currently is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and his most recent books are America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. But we are, according to this results of this recent election, we are a blue country, and we're going to get bluer, and we're going to get more progressive. So again, I feel like our politics are out of step with our population.
Our politics are out of step, but and I think the more that we can do to build a majoritarian blue politics, the better. But I really do think, and a movement-building effort is another part of that, which is not simply politics, but an aggressive activist politics. But I think what people need to actually think about is building the institutional base of a real politics, because that adds, like the labor unions, a real institution and where the muscle is. And I think it's going to come out of a whole series of democratizing efforts of beginning to take over some of the healthcare institutions so that we change the balance of power in health, build up worker-owned companies so we change the balance of power locally. We're seeing this happening quietly. The press doesn't cover it, but we're seeing about 20 states are considering single payer. If you get single payer, you're going to get rid of, that's going to displace one institution, the big healthcare insurance companies. I think what most people think of politics is simply elections and organizing to support different candidates, and that's a huge part of it. And a second part of it is movement building, much more active and aggressive, and demonstrations and sit-ins and civil disobedience, and that's certainly a part of it. But the third part of it, we often forget. Down deep, the reason the Republican governors attacked the labor unions is they know that that institution was really providing a good deal of the muscle behind progressive politics. And, it, you know, labor is down to 7% in the private sector. So another way to do it, I think over time, we're going to have to simply begin displacing some of the powerful institutions. For instance, if you can do as in Vermont now and pass the legislature twice, in California was vetoed, if you do single payer, you will displace the institution of the healthcare insurance companies by a public company, and you start changing the balance of institutional power along with elections and along with movement building. If we can do those three things, build electoral politics, I think that's going to really be the key to changing over time.
Well, Guy Opowitz, so as much as the labor movement has diminished over the years and is down to 6% of the private workforce, still, the president owes labor a lot. He wouldn't have won in Ohio but for the help in the so-called ground game that labor provided.
He certainly does owe labor. We'll see if he actually pays his bills. That is to say, you know, he may compromise. I'd like to see him actually repay his debt to labor, but we'll see if he actually does.
So what are then the pressures on the president? I mean, he's always seems to have had a kind of Wall Street economics team in Geithner and Company. There's no indication that Geithner's leaving. Wall Street didn't give him any money this time. They gave all their money to, they made a big bet on Romney. Again, he doesn't owe Wall Street anything, but he owes labor a lot. So who's weighing in on him, do you think?
Well, I'm sure both sides are weighing in, but he seems to have bought the Wall Street theory of economics, as well as the money, even when he doesn't have the money. Geithner's leaving, but who he appoints as Treasury Secretary may very well reflect the same people because he wants to keep the bond market happy. That's the whole theory of politics out there and theory of finances. We've got to keep those bond traders happy. We've got to be careful with the deficit. So long as that theory predominates, rather than a very different progressive economics, we're trapped, and he'll look the other way when labor comes to the door.
Well, that, of course, is that the chief propagandist for that worldview is Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire who helped finance the Simpson-Bowles Commission. And it's pretty clear what his motivation is and what Wall Street's motivation is in terms of getting their hands on all that Social Security money. I mean, there's nothing particularly complicated about this. So why has it become the holy grail of American politics, deficit reduction? It's a hoax, isn't it? I mean, Social Security pays for itself, for God's sake. What are they talking about?
Well, they're in a trap intellectually and politically. So long as they believe that unless they cut the deficit, the bond market will fall apart and we won't be able to borrow, so long as they believe the stock market will collapse, so long as they believe that, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The only alternative, as I say, the way to think about it as an ordinary citizen is, if there were a large war tomorrow, the economy would be going into high gear, and there would be a big deficit, and no one would be worried about it because it would be moving the economy and paying taxes because the economy was moving. But that requires them to take on Wall Street, requires them to take on a different politics, and we don't see any sign that the progressives have built enough power to make that happen. That's our job for the next years to do that until we can really alter the political dynamics.
So, Gary Alpovitz, are you suggesting then that the bond market is bluffing, that it's kind of a hoax, that they keep telling the president and his advisors that you have to be nice to us because we're holding the line against economic chaos? And, you know, it's such a self-serving argument for them, isn't it?
Well, it is a self-serving argument, but they can, in fact, create a crisis. You remember Bill Clinton faced this. And, you know, his famous line, you mean if I don't do that, those blankety-blank bond traders are controlling the action? The answer is yes. They could run up interest rates and, you know, unless you do a full-scale, bold, ongoing Keynesian program, and I would go beyond that. I think the Keynesians are limited. Unless you're very bold about it and have the politics to make it stick, in the short term, they can cause trouble for you, and they will. So, that would take a lot of different political muscle, political courage to go against them. But if you go full bore against them, you can win. But that's a different politics.
So you're suggesting the president should go full bore because otherwise they'll nickel and dime him to death if he takes the more incremental or modest route. What would going full bore mean to you? Just spell it out if you would.
The full-bore program would be a major public investment in mass transit, in schools, in housing, in roads, in advanced development of energy, many, you know, billions and even up to the trillion-dollar numbers, and move the economy from basically 20% de facto unemployment to 3% and really make the economy work. Think of World War II. Make the economy go full-bore. Then all of a sudden you'd begin seeing tax revenues because everybody's working. But that would take a very bold and a different political culture and a different political leadership to be able to do that. But the economy is a very rich economy that has that capacity. We haven't built the politics to do that, and that's what's missing, the political side.
And what about infrastructure? I mean, it's not just we've seen what's happened with the Hurricane Sandy and the devastation to infrastructure. That's obviously taking a need for a big investment, but there's so much of the rest of the infrastructure, not to mention broadband and other things that could push us into the 21st century. Do you think that the president can make some kind of case that, like Jack Kennedy made for going to the moon? Is that what it's going to require? You know, you talk about going bold. Well, how about, you know, a bold challenge?
That's exactly what would be required, including broadband and including high-speed rail and including mass transit. All of that would be part of a bold package. But that's a different politics, and I don't think this president has that politics, and I don't think any president will have it until we build a movement and also institutions to develop the base for that kind of politics. So I think we're going to get, as you put it, nickel and dime to death, and we're going to find liberals voting to cut Medicare, and we're going to find Social Security later. You know, that's what's going to happen, given we haven't built the politics to make it happen yet. I think that's our job.
Well, but aren't there things happening, though, at the state level as opposed to the federal level? Isn't there some bottom-up movements happening in this country, like community banking and other things that maybe are setting a new example?
That's exactly my hope. That's the new book that you mentioned, What Then Must We Do?, is exactly that, working from the bottom up, building new institutions. There are, you know, the Bank of North Dakota is one, and there are 20 states considering building banks like that, public banks. There are 10,000 worker-owned companies. There are 130 million people in co-ops. There are 5,000 neighborhood corporations. There are 25% of American electricity comes from public utilities and co-ops. It's socialized 25% of the electrical force. Building out from those examples, like the Cleveland co-ops are very interesting developments of worker-owned co-ops in Cleveland and many other cities. That's when you build a new base for the new politics, institutional base, at the same time you build a movement. But that I think, is the job for the next two decades, to really do that, and then I think we have a chance of building a power base to alter the national equations. Bottom-up is always the answer. You can't do it unless you've got the base built up.
Well, you have to add to that list, Guy Alpowitz, too. The city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has the best broadband in the United States.
Yes, indeed. And many cities have done it as well.
Right.
You know, I think several hundred cities have developed really effective broadband publicly, public utilities.
Exactly. Everybody that has either Time Warner or Comcast can tell you that you get lousy services and it gets more and more expensive. And it's, you know, nothing like the speed of what people in France have, for example, that they get for next to nothing as a public utility. So
exactly, public utility and public airlines as well around the world, and public banking. 40% of German banking is public. You can go down the list, and that's the direction we have to build towards. And I think we're just beginning to realize that unless we do that, we're going to not have the institutions that we need to build the next politics.
Well, Guy Alpowitz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Guy Alpowitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors for the New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.